Hello, and welcome to the All Bets Are Off podcast, a gambling addiction recovery podcast brought to you by those with lived experience. If you're here and having difficulties with gambling, please reach out. There are plenty of people on your side. There's a comprehensive list of support services over on our website, www.allbetsareoff.co.uk. It's now time to crack on with the pod.
Hello everyone and welcome to the second instalment of the All Bets Are Off podcast here in season three. And today we're going to be delving into gambling and Chinese culture. I'm here with my incredulous sidekick, Mr. Chris Gillam. And later on in the show, we'll be speaking with Kent Wu from San Francisco. However, our first guest is Edward Kwan, and he has joined us from over in Hong Kong. Edward, it's wonderful to have you on the show. I think it's fair to say that you're a bit of a versatile character in this particular space, an author, consultant, and overriding specialist. Can you break your expertise down for our listeners?
Well, my expertise, I've been a gambling, certified gambling counselor for over 20 years. And but also I have been engaging in corporate training, you know, in terms of applied psychology, you know, that those topics like stress management and empathy, emotional management, conflict management, that sort of things. So I think are all related and to counselling and applied psychology. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Edward. It's great that you've taken time out of your day to come and have a chat with us. Sometimes it can be difficult, I think it's fair to say, logistically sorting out guests in the UK. But with you, I have to say it's been relatively plain sailing. I first came across you in an article on the South China Morning Post article in 2019 about why Chinese students are at risk of becoming gambling addicts in the UK. And I guess, you know, this is as good a place as any to start, really. In that piece, you talked about vulnerabilities, and I quote, "It can be like a parachutist landing in a minefield." What did you mean by that? And can you add a little bit more context?
Okay, to give you a little bit of the background of that metaphor, which I used during the interview by the South China Morning Post in London. I was giving a kind of seminar in London to the Chinese community on my theory on the coping and the impact on the Chinese female spouse of problem gambler in Hong Kong. And after that seminar, one of the attendees is a South China Morning Post correspondent. That's the background. And then we later arranged an interview and had a bit of dim sum in Chinatown, of course. And during that interview, we talk about a lot of things, and one of the things is about Chinese student, you know, going over to UK for overseas study. And as we know, from 2018, there was about 15,000 Chinese students, and then there was an increase up to 19,000 in 2019. So a very significant increase in the number of students going to UK. And that's how it raised my concern, you know, and with a little bit of background, you know, I was visiting Cambridge, and then, out of curiosity, of course, also a kind of professional observation, I went to a lab room, you know, and to play a few pong and talk to my nephew, say, let's go and win a few bucks. And are you kidding? You know, you're a kind of you're a gambling expert, you know, are you serious? I said, yes, I am serious, you know. And then I had that kind of personal first-hand experience playing a poker machine in the lab room, you know, and that relate the two experience, you know, my experience, you know, playing with a few pong in the lab room and knowing a lot of Chinese students in UK. And actually that metaphor, I say, it's like describing those Chinese overseas students. They are, they could be lonely. They could be out of touch with their family, even though now we have all the technology for communication. But psychologically, they are thousands of miles away from home. Assuming they are, you know, relatively spoiled, you know, under the one child policy in China during the early childhood to early adulthood, you know, and that strong sense of loneliness away from home could be one of the emotional risks that I use that metaphor to present, that like they are jumping off like a parachute into a foreign minefield. With that metaphor of minefield, I mean curiosity, you know, attraction, you know, something new in UK, you know, what is a poker machine, you know, what is a labrobe, you know, that kind of a metaphor I use.
It's really, really interesting, Edward, actually. And I totally get what you're saying there. You know, I mean, even a student in the UK who moves to another town or city, you know, will feel lonely, potentially, you know, missing their family. So to be that far away from home, and being kind of based in Essex myself and working in London, you know, I spent many an afternoon when I took an afternoon off work in Chinatown. So yeah, a bit of dim sum myself as well. And then into the bookmakers there. And it's absolutely incredible, because it is like Chinese bookmakers, isn't it? You know, like the language and everything in there. It is like a bit of China in London. And therefore, you know, I imagine that's a place where people feel at home as well. And then it's got all the bookmakers there as well. Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And I love that metaphor that you use, actually. And but I think that we can very quickly discount academia and intelligence, because many people I've met in recovery have been incredibly bright people. And the UK itself has a very large Chinese population of over 430,000. And this is the largest group of immigrants from any country in the UK. And the majority tend to do very well academically, you know, like with 97% going on to further education. And so it's fair to say that this intrinsic attraction to gambling might well be more from a cultural perspective, maybe, or possibly even a cultural predisposition. I mean, what do you think about that, Edward?
Well, you mentioned academia. I'm sure quite a portion of the problem gambler, they are very bright in terms of like in terms of mathematics, and you know, and actually I have a client, you know, have a master in mathematics, and he and his friend form a group and went to Macau, and really, you know what, they purchase a machine and really broke up the machine, and you know, and did analysis on the mechanics on the machine, you know, and with their background as, you know, as bright mathematician, you know, so certain number of gambler, they have that background. But I think most of the student in general, they have that kind of, when you say cultural disposition, I would maybe more specifically thinking about their family upbringing. Assuming that like if their parent or one of their parent already have a kind of gambling habit during their childhood, you know, that would be a kind of family influence, or you can call it in a more general, a broader term, cultural disposition. And you know, this kind of already kind of upbringing experience, and bringing this kind of background experience abroad to UK, you know, and then with the strong sense of loneliness, and you know, when first time, you know, socializing with other peer student. And then when they step into a betting shop, you know, there are about 9,000, 8,000 some betting shop in UK. Must be one nearby, you know, must be one very accessible. And then when they go in, they feel really a sense of belonging. The Chinese character, or maybe playing a bit of music or of Oriental music. So you can see it's both the kind of personal and internal factor come to play with the external environmental factor, and that could be a very powerful attractive force for the student to continue to engage in the gambling.
Thanks for that, Edward. Yeah, I mean, in terms of having a mathematical brain, I think you're quite correct there. Most disorder gamblers will have. I know myself is. I was very quick thinking on the old maths when I was in a betting shop and you know, playing poker and such. I had to have that mathematical mind. Now, unfortunately, because research into gambling addiction here in the UK has been that poor in terms of prevalence and from a cultural perspective, I'm having to state this next point very much from a first-hand anecdotal perspective from my time in active addiction and the many hours that I spent in casinos. Now, it has to be said that in London and the surrounding areas, that there was always a very high Chinese presence, and unlike any other ethnic groups, there was often a relatively high percentage of female gamblers. Now, is this a widespread tendency and something that we see in China too?
Oh, yeah. I think there is generally a rise of female gambler, not necessary to classify them into a problem or pathological gambler yet. But as I observe, like occasionally I went to Macau, I went into different casino in Macau for the purpose of making observation. And I did observe more and more Chinese female, you know, in the casino playing, you know, blackjack and all kind of card game. And just to quote you a very vivid example, there was a lady I observed, you know, with a handbag, you know, a very luxury handbag, and all that inside are all cash, renminbi. You know, it's just very very general for a Chinese moderate business lady bringing like 300k or 400k renminbi over to Macau for gambling. You know, of course, that maybe just represent a small percentage, but as I observe, more and more female and also young female are really sitting in the card game table in Macau. And I think all over in Asia, like Singapore, the Sentosa Casino, the resort, you know, and in Malaysia, the Jintan Highland Resort, as I've been delivering training to the floor manager there to identify potential gambler, you know, who may be very emotional, upset, or has the potential or risk of committing suicide within premises of the casino. And I did observe more and more a female are participating in the game, and I think one of the reasons is they are more and more education opportunity, and they are more and more economic opportunity. And one of the reasons why more and more female engage in gambling could be due to a kind of lack of intimate relationship, as they spend more and more time in their career, making a lot of money, but at the same time, neglecting their personal need on intimacy. And that could be a compensation or escape for them.
It's very interesting that, Edward. I've never thought of it in that sense before. But I can totally see it. I can totally see it now that you say it. And I guess from my personal experience as well, you know, I haven't been into a land-based casino since 2015 because I self-excluded from all land-based casinos two and a half years before I finished gambling, to be honest. But then, whether I was in the casino, the Aspers in Stratford or somewhere near Leicester Square, there were a lot of Chinese women in there. You know, I'd regularly be surrounded by them. That's not because they were chasing me, I'm sure. Just, you know, they just happened to be in the same vicinity. But keeping to the topic of women gamblers, I know from your communications with Ryan that you've some research on female spouses, actually, of Chinese problem gamblers in Hong Kong. So can you tell us some more about that and what was uncovered in that particular area of research?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So after my private practice in counselling mostly male gambler, I realised that for a kind of smooth and true recovery for the problem gambler, we have to adopt a kind of co-recovery model. By that, I mean we should move away from the male center or problem gambler centered paradigm and not just still fixated at the medical model treating the male gambler as the patient per se. And for true recovery, we have to take into account the significant others, of course, the spouse, of course, the female spouse, because generally, up to now, still majority of the gambler are male, statistically. So for a kind of co-recovery, we have to take into account of the female spouse, how they interpret the impact, and especially how they cope with the impact. And my doctoral research is on the a Hong Kong sample of a Chinese female spouse of problem gambler in Hong Kong. And I found that after analysis, I found there are 17 coping strategies adopted by the female spouse. And with these 17 different, sometimes even opposing coping strategy, I discovered there are basically three paradigms of the female spouse. The first one, easy to understand, is the problem gambler center paradigm. That means the female spouse would do anything, borrowing money, telling lies, covering up for the gambler, even, go bankrupt for the gambler, to save him, to bail him out. And I'm sure you two gentlemen, I don't know, from your personal experience, that you guys might have some one or more than one female, bailing you guys out in those days, in those years. And to put you into perspective, those female significant others or female partner, they most of the time were operating within the problem gambler center paradigm. Whatever they do for the gambler. The second paradigm is called the family relationship center paradigm. In particular, for those couple with children, the female spouse, they would either do something for themselves or for the gambler, but within this paradigm, they would consider the children. Divorce? No. Don't divorce. Maintain the status quo of the family. They don't want the children to grow up in a quote-unquote broken family. They don't want the children to grow up in quote-unquote a single parent family. Of course, in the West, it's relatively more liberal. Chinese culture is relatively more conservative in the sense they want to maintain that family status quo. So this is the paradigm. When they consider doing something, whatever, avoiding conflict with the gambler, or maybe saving up some money for the children, this time I won't bail out the gambler. This time I won't do it under the problem gambler center paradigm. I do it under the family relationship center paradigm. I save up some money, I keep it in secret. Why? For my children, summer activity, for the school fee, etc., etc. The third paradigm I discover is, which is the least used paradigm, that is the self-care paradigm or self-care center paradigm. As it, very self-explanatory. The female spouse, most of the time, seldom really engage and operate their coping strategy, to generate coping strategy from this paradigm, self-care, or Chris or Ryan, if the female significant next to you, if she thought about, oh no, this time I must take a break. This time, let me spend a little bit of money to buy myself a new dress. Let me spend a little bit of money to dine out a little bit with my female friends or whatever, for years. I've been saving and spending all the money for this gentleman. So that is a kind of self-care paradigm. So basically, with these three paradigms, we can explain why there is such a diversity of coping strategy or even sometimes opposing coping strategy. And as we all know, a very international, well-known expert, Mr. Jim Offit in UK, he has been doing a lot of research on coping, you know, by significant others of addicts like alcohol or drug. I think my discovery is quite complementary to the finding in UK.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Edward. And what we'll do is we'll put a link to the research in the podcast description so that others will be able to view that. It's quite interesting when you talk about you know, significant others and female spouses. I know from my personal perspective, I certainly didn't have more than one female on the go at the same time, as per your assertion. But and it's something that we spoke about on previous podcasts. Mine was about almost, I guess I almost profiled female partners to understand, and it sounds really sadist now I say it, to understand how I could get something out of them, you know, and it was primarily for my own financial gain. And that sounds really sad and pathetic, I know, but that's what my addiction drove me to, really. And forgive my ignorance here, just changing the subject, but going back to the anecdotal perspective I gave earlier, I did want to ask, whenever I was in the casinos and wasting a heap of money on roulette, I did happen to notice that the number 8 and its surrounding numbers was always heavily backed by Chinese people. Can you tell us the significance of the number 8?
Oh, yes, the pronunciation of this number, but I mean, in our in Chinese language, the we pronounce number 8 like this, but, and this pronunciation but is close to the pronunciation of prosperity. So you see the link, the number 8 pronunciation and the pronunciation is close to the concept of riches, prosperity. So that's a kind of linguistic superstition then.
I see. Thanks for that.
That's interesting. I've never even noticed that. I used to bet on 2 and 5, mainly 2, and a bit of 5. So I was just above the Chinese people on the table there then, by the looks of it. But yeah, I hadn't noticed. But bringing the discussion back to the seeming attraction to gambling for Chinese immigrants to the UK, obviously, other than the state-run welfare lottery and the sports lottery, gambling is illegal in China. Do you think, what, with having a much more liberal approach like we do in the UK, then it makes it an attractive pastime? And if so, would you personally consider gambling a dangerous pastime?
Even though I'm a gambling specialist, counselling problem with, compulsory or whatever pathological, or now, you know, classified by the DSM-5 as a kind of gambling disorder, I personally don't object to gambling as a pastime. And I don't regard this as dangerous per se. If you say gambling is dangerous, I think it is not that scientifically proven, you know, it's a game. But I would rather say it in a more psychological perspective. Whoever the person, you know, young student, university student, if they have an unstable mood is one of the risk factor. Either that person is in a high mood, very excited, very euphoric, you know, then that he or she would be disposed to think luck is around. And to the contrary, if that person is at a low mood, depressed, and probably that person need a bit of stimulation, neural stimulation, you know, why not go to a casino with all the flashing and the sound, and, you know, as a kind of a therapy, you know, and audio video therapy. So I think it's that kind of a danger or risk. I would put more emphasis on the personal side rather than on the external side. So for China, I think because China is a socialist country, so far I don't see they would have a tendency to legalize gambling in addition to the lottery they already have. And but even though this is the situation, but actually years ago I already have cases across the border, you know, just I have to, you know, on a weekly basis, I went across the border to a park in Shenzhen to see a family and their son, after losing $6 million renminbi in online gambling. So I think it's already plenty of opportunity via online gambling that China is already facing a huge problem of gambling addiction, even without, you know, legalizing it to a more acceptable pastime.
I just wanted to ask Edward, from a educational perspective, because it's illegal in China, do the children have education on gambling in schools at all?
I think so far it's not that popular or really in demand yet. To the contrary, rather, you know, a lot of research been done on like a mobile dependency. You know, of course, there's also on the field of addiction, dependency, you know, in that direction. But a lot of research, a lot of education in secondary school, you know, public awareness, yes. But gambling, I would say, is still a taboo topic. I don't think many academia within the university now dare or want to or willing to really probe into this area, as you know, maybe such a move would raise the eyebrow of the government. You know, what are you doing? Is there a real problem there? So that, I think this is the situation. But I think under the table already there is a very concern about online gambling by people, you know, at all different walk of life in China.
Yeah, I guess that sort of intrigue can potentially drive consumers there as well. What I've got to say, I mean, it's been brilliant chatting to you today, Edward. An absolute pleasure having you on the show with us today. And I'm sure Chris and our listeners all agree that it's been a real eye-opener. Can I ask, rounding things off, do you have any plans at all in terms of visiting the UK anytime in the future?
Oh, yeah, I have a very strong connection with UK. You know, usually I come over to Manchester, and actually my two sons graduate from UCL in London. You see, I have a very strong connection with UK. Yeah, I would love to visit the UK, you know, once the Hong Kong COVID-19 situation get better. You know, we just get worse in these 2 weeks. Oh, my God. Terrible.
Hopefully by the time this episode goes out, things are starting to look a little bit brighter at least. Well, if you ever happened to touch down in London, obviously once things do have resemble a sense of normality, then obviously give us a shout and we'll be delighted to meet you. You know, thank you for your time today. It's been really good. As for you at home, please stick around and join us for part two after this short break.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to us today. The All Bets Are Off podcast is brought to you in association with Gamban, and they've teamed up with GamCare and GamStop to formulate TalkBanStop. The TalkBanStop campaign offers a trio of free tools to prevent gambling harm. With support via GamCare's National Gambling Helpline, free Gamban blocking software, and GamStop self-exclusion. Head to www.talkbanstop.com for more information. TalkBanStop is only available in the UK, but to block your devices from accessing gambling sites and apps, you can get Gamban at gamban.com or on the App Store or Play Store, wherever you are in the world. Now though, it's time to get back into the pod.
Hello and welcome back to part two. I'm still here with co-host Chris, and we've been joined by a new guest, a certain Mr. Kent Wu from San Francisco. Hello, Kent. Great to have you here with us. Can we start by talking a little bit more about you, your job role and experiences in general? And I'm especially keen to hear all about the Nikos Chinese Health Coalition.
Great. Thank you, Ryan and Chris, for having me. I'm really excited to be here. So Nico's Chinese Health Coalition is a nonprofit in San Francisco. And as we describe ourselves, we're a public-private community partnership of more than 30 health and human service organizations. And our mission specifically is to enhance the health and well-being of San Francisco's Chinese community. So we do a number of projects here. One of them is the Chinatown Community Health Fair, which is an annual event that we put on that serves about 500 people from around the community and from around the city, mostly people who have limited access to healthcare. And so we provide them with that access by convening hospitals, health clinics, and social service providers, and then provide them information and screenings. We also do a COVID-19 network where we work with the different nonprofits around the city to make sure that the prevention and the intervention needs of the community are met with regard to coronavirus and COVID-19 prevention. We also do a problem gambling project, which is what I think you're probably most interested in. And this is a project that we started more than 20 years ago. And how we had come about doing this project was we had conducted what was called the Chinese Community Health Study in 1998. The purpose of the health study was actually to develop a health profile of Chinese American adults in San Francisco. And it was to document the community's healthcare access, usage, and needs. Of all the questions we asked, we also asked one social question. And that was, out of all these, what do you consider to be a problem for your community? And as it turned out, more people identified gambling than any other issue. And because of that, we felt we need to address it. And from that point on, we worked with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. We got some funding, and then we started up our own program. As it is now, it is a comprehensive program. So we do outreach and education. We go to community health fairs like our own. We go to other community events. We publicize a helpline that people can call most times of the day. And we also work with the state's Department of Public Health, who will pay counselors to work with the clients that we identify as needing more assistance or counseling.
Thanks for that, Kent. That's an incredibly interesting answer. And to think, you know, you've been going for 20 years now with that program, that kind of, I was kind of taken aback by that. I didn't realize you guys had been, had realized, you know, gambling was such an issue back then, and the fact that the population realized it as well when answering that question. You know, something actually that we touched upon a little bit earlier with Edward in the first half of the show was that the research side of things, and similar to the UK, it seems that there's a real gap in the research around ethnicity and the part that plays as a risk factor in gambling disorder. With a very sizable Chinese American population of around 4 million people, just how much of a concern is that to you?
It's a great concern to us. We're actually very much concerned that the needs are not being documented. So that study that I had mentioned to you that Nikos had conducted, we had conducted it in English and several dialects of Chinese. So we did it in Cantonese, Mandarin, and Toisan, which are the three major dialects here in San Francisco. Generally, when the studies are done around prevalence on gambling, it's usually done in English only. So when the statistics come out, generally, it's not capturing those who are most vulnerable, those people who are low income, limited English proficient, and or otherwise not really connected to American culture in general. One thing we have to remember is that when people come into the country, they may be limited English speaking. And so that means there are very limited things that they can do. But gambling is something that they don't need to speak English in order to do. And if you ever notice around casinos, they tend to hire a lot of Chinese speaking staff in order to accommodate the population, which is quite concerning in itself.
Yeah, and definitely failing to document is a huge problem over here as well, especially when there isn't a public health approach to gambling addiction. And I think what's really concerning is the seemingly targeted approach from gambling companies. I know that over here, for example, there are a lot of bookmakers in and around the Westminster sort of Chinatown area. And a few years back, they were keeping some of them open until midnight because their new business would be booming, particularly among the Chinese population. It was definitely well targeted, and we've carried out research ourselves in terms of the locations of betting shops in areas in high density of Black and mixed ethnicity communities. I've also read articles that there are similar profiling or targeting over there in America too. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, The casinos and card rooms, certainly around California, are very targeted in their approach of the population. So it's almost impossible to watch a television broadcast in Chinese or to read a Chinese newspaper or listen to Chinese radio without hearing or seeing at least one ad for gambling. That could be for online gambling, it could be for the casinos, it could be for card rooms. It's all over there. When we've held our Chinese New Year events in San Francisco Chinatown, generally the card rooms and the casinos will come out and do outreach at those events as well. While we were pretty successful in keeping actual gambling establishments out of San Francisco Chinatown, there have been attempts to set up off-track betting, for instance, and other types of similar kind of venues. We've been less successful in keeping out like tour bus agencies or casino agencies themselves that set up these types of tours to take the population out into their establishments. But as you say, it's a very targeted approach, and it's not just here in California, it's not just here in San Francisco, it's wherever there's a very large Chinese population. So we've heard the same thing from people who are in Seattle, Washington, for instance, or Boston, Massachusetts, across the United States. Even in Cleveland, Ohio, we've heard of this, which is a place where there's a very limited population.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And do you know what? It doesn't surprise me at all. You know, I feel like we have the same issues over here with regards to the advertising and that kind of stuff. And, you know, during the daytime, you know, they'll be advertising for I don't know, mums who are at home during the day with their kids, you know, and in the evening it might change for a different kind of audience. And that happens. And in Chinatown as well, I've been to those betting shops. And earlier in part one, when we were talking to Edward, you know, I mentioned about going into those bookmakers in Chinatown, and, you know, it's there. It's specifically there for that population. So I totally understand what you're saying and where you're coming from. And before the break, we also touched upon the cultural aspect of things, and research papers state that many Asian Americans grew up with traditional notions that gambling is an acceptable social activity, and their families may routinely engage in various forms of gambling during cultural celebrations, for example. And further to that, some papers suggest that there's an element or a predisposition. Can you give us your perspective on gambling in Chinese culture, and is gambling normalized from a young age?
Yes, I would say that gambling is very much normalized in many Chinese households and from a very young age. So, for instance, from my own experience, I grew up around gambling. So whenever there was a celebration, there were always MJ games, Mahjong games going on, in which money was being bet and other stakes. I actually learned how to play Mahjong from my grandmother, and I spent many summers gambling with my grandmother and my siblings. Not just Mahjong, but also other games like blackjack. And it was just a part of our growing up. It's so normalized in the community, however, that when we did that study that I mentioned, we did a follow-up study later on with some UC Berkeley Masters of Social Work students. The first question that they asked was, do you gamble? And most people responded no. The next question was, which one of these activities have you participated in the past month? And even those people who checked off no, still checked off, played Mahjong for money, bought lottery tickets, played poker with my friends, and what have you. So we think that it's so much into our culture and our just daily activity that we don't even recognize some of these things as gambling anymore.
I understand where they were coming from, I think, with that, because I know when I was gambling, for example, is when I came into recovery, I then realized upon reflection just how difficult it was to change that. As I've referred to on the podcast before, it's sort of retraining my brain in terms of every time I went into a shop, I would be buying a scratch card, and I didn't really consider it as gambling, but of course it is. And I totally understand where they're coming from. Keeping with the research line, Ken, it is estimated that Asian Americans are more than three times likelier than Caucasians to be classified as problem gamblers. But much like a lot of research in this space, methodology has been somewhat of a problem. I know you touched upon language barriers earlier on, Kent, and some of it also being done over the telephone, and it just seems a little shoddy, if truth be told. What are the challenges, and how do we go about improving research?
Well, I think one would be defining what gambling is. As I mentioned, a lot of folks don't consider what they're doing to be gambling. So being clear about what gambling is, but putting up money or putting up other stakes for the purpose of winning or losing. And then also doing it language concordant, as I had mentioned before. So making sure that the surveys are done in language as well, and in a way that folks know that it's confidential, whatever they say, because that is also a very important part of willingness for the population to open up and actually admit to different things. There's a whole different methodology, I think, for reaching Asian American populations as there is to the general population. There's a really great need for confidentiality and for ensuring that confidentiality and responses from the population. That's one of the things that we had to very clearly emphasize also in publicizing our helpline. So in the very beginning, we didn't get a whole lot of calls. It was not until we started to really emphasize the fact that all calls are confidential, that people were able to reveal more and actually connect with us in that way.
Do you think it's a lot about trust as well? I mean, what I mean by that, comparing that to sort of some of the research that's happened in the UK, is that you, and in fact, just working within communities, you tend to find that, for example, people of Chinese ethnicity would be inclined to open up and engage with other Chinese people. And we see that over here in the UK. So, you know, in terms of in the Muslim communities, for example, is they don't often want to open up to what they perceive to be outsiders, yet they will happily engage with sort of faith leaders within their local community. Do you think that that's of benefit as well for the Chinese population?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So people, the interviewer reflecting the population, the interviewer being from a trusted source, like a community-based agency, those would all make a huge difference in the person establishing that trust and being willing to open up about issues, especially around something as sensitive as gambling.
Yeah, I mean, to me, very, very important, you know, to get that trust. If you don't have trust, I think there's something around authenticity there as well, isn't there, actually? You know, if you feel you can relate to someone, you can feel that it's authentic and you can really be truthful.
A lot of the prevalent studies that have been done here in the US, and especially in California, have been done by government sources also. And that's another issue of concern, because if you're getting a call from the government and they're asked, you're an immigrant to the country, they're asking you about your gambling habits, you're not going to be very truthful or forthcoming, because it might jeopardize your citizenship or your chances of becoming a citizen. And also you're not wanting to tell big government about any problems that you might be having.
I totally appreciate that, Kent. Absolutely. Yeah, you don't want kind of government big brother looking over you and asking questions. You're never quite sure what it's going to mean when you give the answer. So totally get that. But unfortunately, we've got to start to wrap things up. It'd be a shame not to consider your own personal position on how things are in the States right now, Kent. Around 25% of our listeners are based in the US, actually. And so in season two, we did a stateside special and talked about the risks and concerns now that the gambling market is opening up in America. So with you being in San Francisco, what concerns do you have that we haven't already explored today?
I think we're just generally concerned about the easy access to gambling. So we've always been concerned about the casinos and the card rooms, and then all the buses that have been coming into the community almost on a 24/7 basis, taking people out and bringing them to these gambling establishments. But now there's much more than that. There's also online gambling. There's the isolation related to sheltering in place for COVID-19. It's just so readily available right now that there's so many more chances for someone to become addicted to gambling. Especially in San Francisco Chinatown, there are stores that sell lottery tickets almost on every block. It's just so available that it's very concerning to us. We're getting ready right now to launch another study just to find out where things are at this point. Has the isolation and the effects of COVID-19 sheltering in place made things better or worse? Has it cut off some access, or has it driven them to online sources? We've read different messages about this, different news articles. In some countries, it's worked out for the better. In some countries, it's worked out for the worst. So we want to know what it's like here locally in San Francisco and in the Bay Area.
I wanted to ask as well, Kent, do you think that America are prepared in terms of education and prevention and also from a treatment perspective, the sheer scale of the potential problems that you might have?
Yeah, I think we definitely need to be at the ready for whatever it might be. We definitely need to build up our bilingual, bicultural, mental health workforce here in San Francisco. So it's just something that we always need to be at the ready for. Again, there's just so many more avenues for gambling. There's so many more enticements. We don't know what's happening with the younger generation now that there are video games that are kind of a prelude or a gateway for gambling as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks for that. And that's something that we're definitely going to be exploring later on in season three with regards to loot boxes and gaming. Brilliant, Ken. I just wish to thank you for coming on and speaking with us today. It's been a forthright and open discussion and one I'm sure that ourselves and our listeners can take a lot from.
Great. Glad to be here, and thanks again for the invitation.
Thank you very much. And as for our listeners, join us next week as we delve into the role of gambling in football with director John Peel of Lewis Football Club and Nick Hutt, co-owner of Billericay Town. Until next time, stay safe and remain gamble-free. Thank you.
You've been listening to the All Bets Are Off podcast. To find out more about the creators of the pod, then please visit our website, www.allbetsareoff.co.uk. And don't forget to give us a follow on Twitter at allbetsareoff_ and share this podcast with others. Until next time, stay safe and remain gamble-free. Thank you for listening.